Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the man who's about as entertaining as fuel tax is Dave Hutty.
Hello.
Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or your home insurance. Now then, Dave, that's unusual to have a little scripted note like that where you have a little pop at yourself.
Well, you know, I thought, if anyone's going to have a pop at you, it's better to have a pop at yourself because then it stops other people doing it, see? So I was just getting in there first.
But
you're looking very well, Jason. You're looking a little bit rugged today, a little bit a little bit beardy.
No shave this morning. Monday morning, unusual for me, but I couldn't be asked.
Well, that's fair enough because you were too excited about the guests that we have in store for us today.
Bingo, right in one. Now, our guest today is a gentleman I know well. He's a TV presenter, a journalist, a campaigner, an author, and a champion of the British motorsport. You'll know him from presenting the likes of Britain's Worst Driver, Fifth Gear, and the early incarnations of a BBC show, which you might know, called Top Gear.
Top Gear.
It is, of course, Quentin Wilson. Hello, mate. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Yes, very good. Very good.
Quentin, thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. You are the proud owner of a highly extensive CV, as Jason has just alluded to. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to flip the script, if you like, and kick off with a question that ordinarily we would preserve to the end. And that question is this. Of all the many things you've done and all the things you've achieved, what are you most proud of?
That's a hard one, really. I guess saving consumers $120 billion on fuel duty was pretty good. So 10 years of campaigning and making the government keep the fuel duty escalator down added up to this saving of $120 billion. And the Treasury reluctantly said, that Wilson's campaign will be felt for decades to come. Mm-hmm. And we raised GDP by, I think, 0.5%, which in an era of flat growth was pretty important. All that 2008, 2009 recession, we put all that money back into consumers' pockets. So that's good. Mm-hmm. That, I think, would probably be the greatest achievement.
I mean, that's an amazing number, Quentin. Staggering amount of money.
But you remember, you were old enough to remember Alistair Darling, that Labour chancellor who said that we were going to put up fuel duty by inflation plus an escalator every single year. So I thought, look, by the time, 4 or 5 years, we'll be looking at £2 a litre.
Yeah.
So stepped in and said, look, this is no good, and went to Cameron, who'd just got in then and said, we've got to stop this. And bless him, he did. And he was the first one before Sunak to actually lop money off fuel duty and said we are the party that lowers fuel duty. But it was good. And I mean, look, people say, look, all that CO2 going to the atmosphere and all that. But that was then, and this is now. I mean, at that time, we needed that support for the economy because you forget how bad 2008, 2009, 2010 were in terms of, they call it the Great Recession now, don't they? But people were really, really struggling. And I think it made a difference.
I've known you for a long time, but I don't know the early history. Where did it all start? You know, your love affair with the motor car. Was that the turn of the century? but where did it begin? Yeah, what catalyzed it?
I remember as a kid, because I had academic parents, university professors. And, they weren't interested in cars. And I, as a tiny boy, remember thinking that these things were wonderful, magical things that would give you a new identity and make you the hero. I pushed my dad to go from a Vauxhall Victor into a Daimler Sovereign. He went reluctantly.
Okay.
And my mother from a Ford Anglia into a Sunbeam Alpine and then a Sunbeam Tiger.
Tiger.
Yeah. Racket. £495, Jason.
Is that right?
Yeah. In Carnival Red. I still remember it now.
Wow.
So just pushed all that as a kid at school. And then between school and university, I was getting my mum to drive the cars that I would buy because I had a job in Hepworth, the men's outfitter, which you probably don't remember. And saved up some Saturday money and started buying and selling cars between school and university. And And it just all kind of came from that. So by the time I was reading my English literature books at uni, I was driving in Jensen Interceptors and stuff. But you could buy them for nothing there. I remember buying an E-Type for £295 with the clutch gone in the basement of a nightclub in Leicester, and taking it home and getting my mate to fix the clutch with me. And then we drove it round. And it was just, you know, the best thing imaginable. And you would pick up women, and you would have this fantastic nightlife. And
they
showed you the wicked delights of adulthood. So I then met a lovely bloke. Well, sold cars for quite a while. I met a lovely bloke called Steve Cropley, who you'll probably know.
Yes. Yeah.
Who is still, you know, I think one of the world's best car journalists. Mm. And he started up this car magazine called Buying Cars. And I wrote for it, and it was very brave. And up to that point, car magazines had only talked about shiny, brand new cars. And talking about, this was early 90s, wasn't it? Talking about secondhand cars was slightly dirty and déclassé. Nobody really wanted to know about them. And we really hit the nail on the head with this. And I remember the first issue... I was interviewed by The Sun and The Mirror and The Mail and Radio 1 and Radio 2 and even Radio 4. And it became really quite a hit. And then I got this call from this man called John Bentley, who you know, dear old John.
Everybody knows John.
At that stage, was a producer for Top Gear, and he sounded like a vicar. And he said, could you possibly see your way clear to coming over to Pebble Mill and having a little screen test? So I kind of didn't take it seriously and went over and did a screen test. And it just all happened like that. It just instantly happened. And I'd met Clarkson before at a launch. And we got on, you know, famously from the moment we met, just disreputable and irreverent, like all the same things. And it all just came together. And that was that. So I did 15 years Top Gear. Mm-hmm. And you know, with Jeremy, I think those early programs were quite good because we it was a very closed world of motoring journalists who were broadly just there for the ride, weren't they? The club class hotel and airplane seat and the little gift and the free car and all that sort of stuff. And you really weren't supposed to say horrible things about cars. It wasn't done. And if you did say horrible things about cars, you wouldn't really get an invite to the next launch. So it was a very kind of gentlemanly club. And then we turn up. And Pebble Mill back then was sweet, and we were very lucky because we had this really lovely guy called Dennis Adams, who was dressed entirely in man-made fibres, you know, acrylic jumper, acrylic trousers, and plastic shoes. But he was so lovely, and he just let us do what we wanted to do. So we were able to take on the entire global motor industry on this little programme that came out on Thursday on BBC Two. And I remember John Towers saying to me, Quentin, when it gets to 8:30 on BBC Two, the entire motor industry reaches for the Valium because we don't... And I mean, it was... Toyota banned Jeremy from driving their test cars. They had a little stamp put on the docket you get when you get a road test car. This car is not insured for Jeremy Clarkson. I called...
That's hilarious.
The entire Longbridge production line to go on strike because I was horrible to the Metro, the Vectra, all those early things which just turned motoring journalism on its head.
Yeah.
And nobody really kind of stopped us. And that was great. And Dennis, bless him, if you're listening, you know, you trusted us, which I wouldn't have done because, you know, we were just totally out of control with our jeans and our leather jackets. But it was great because I think it heralded an era of much more critical, incisive car journalism. And Clarkson would say, you know, this car has got great headroom and great shoulder room, but there's the back seats are rubbish, so fat people won't be able to sit in them, but that's their fault for eating too much. And all those mangled metaphors and sorry similes also that came into it. This car will snap nickel elastic at 200 yards.
Yeah, yeah. Or,
classic.
Or this car is like Catherine Deneuve dipped in chocolate sauce. You just couldn't say that sort of stuff now. Mm. But, you know, people even now come up to me and say, I remember those things you used to do and say. And they were just screamingly funny. And he and I would write this stuff kind of late at night, smoking red Marlboros and drinking vodka and coming up with all these similes and things. And we didn't really take it that seriously. And we kind of laid the foundations for this really different critical style of automotive journalism.
Presumably with that then, Quentin, I suppose as your popularity increases as a show and in turn, obviously, you as journalist with yourself and Clarkson, it means that you're able to actually say more cutting things? Because you were saying before that, obviously, you know, you had to sort of toe the line a little bit, because if you did say something nasty, you wouldn't then get that next car. But I suppose, you know, there's an edging forward, isn't it, which ultimately then has produced, you know, the critical journalism which you're known for and Top Gear has gone on to be famous for.
Yeah, I remember it was probably demonstrated by the Escort Mark IV, which we drove, and we both came to the conclusion that it was a steaming conical pile of horse poo. Really, really, really bad car. And we went to Dennis and said, look, this car's crap. We're going to say this. So, he said, you can't. This is the best-selling car. Mm. This is Ford's, you know, family car. How can it be so bad? So we took Dennis out in it and showed him that it handled like a pair of wide fronts in a tumble dryer, and then mooing noise from the engine. And he said, okay, maybe it's not as good as people think. So we recorded this piece, and then he said, okay, if the rest of the motoring press follow this criticism, then we'll do it. We'll screen it. If not, you know, we're going to have to hold back. So we waited on the station for the autocar to come off and opened it up, and another duff fast Ford or another duff Ford. Mm-hmm. And Dennis said, okay, you can do the piece. So we were right. Our judgment calls were always right. I mean, the Vectra really was a dull, dull car, and it was absolutely right to say that. But there was this pressure that, you know, John Burt was always being rung up by manufacturers and later on, you know, the ambassadors of countries saying, you know, how can you say this stuff? How do you let these people on your show get away with it? And I remember the managing director of Renault said, after we rubbished his pointless Renault Spider, I want you to all the advertising on the BBC. And that was it. We could get away with it. There were no advertisers and nobody to offend. So Jeremy was writing for The Sun, I was writing for The Mirror, and we kind of just changed the way people talked about cars, and it's good.
Yeah. Let me take you back to the beginning then, in terms of passing your test is obviously a huge rite of passage for everybody, and it's something that I think that we all remember. What did it feel like to you at that age, presumably at 17, in terms of the freedom that it would then afford you?
Well, for me, it was a bit different because all these cars I was driving cars when I was a kid in America, because my dad went to Chicago and took the whole family with him to teach at a university there. So we had a sabbatical year in Chicago. So as an 11-year-old, I was driving Pontiac GTOs and big block Corvettes with this mad kid called Nicky Atwood, whose father had a GM dealership. Mm-hmm. So at school, we'd skip and go home on our bikes and go into the father's lot, and the keys were all in the sun visors. And then we would drive these cars through the cornfields. I mean, just madness when you think about it. Mm. But I am alive today to tell you this story, which I think remarkable. So that's kind of where I was able to drive from an early age. So passing my test in the UK, well, I mean, come on, I'd driven a GTO and a Dodge Charger Road and Track.
Wow, fantastic!
So yeah, it was an expectation, and that meant I could drive these nutcase cars that you could buy for nothing around. So you know, it wasn't a Mini or a Fiesta. I was just buying the maddest, most crazy cars I could find, like Jensen CV8s, Iso Revoltas, you know, because they were just nothing then, absolutely nothing. And you could sell them and you could make, you know, 500 quid and run them for a couple of weeks, and it was just great, you know.
The good old days of motoring.
They were,
eh?
The good old days. I wish I'd kept them all in a warehouse.
Oh, can you imagine? Yeah. 250 quid on an E-Type.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, they're telephone numbers now, aren't they, if it's a nice one?
Yeah, yeah. I sold one for £202,000 to Bernie Eccleston, so, you know, they've gone up a bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, first car, did you say it was your mum's Anglia? Was that the first car you
actually... The first car properly I put my money to was a Frog Eye Sprite. So it was a little 1959, 1960 Speedwell Blue Frog Eye Sprite. And that was my car, which she drove home from the dealer's lot. And I, you know, painted it with aerosols and smarted it up and, you know, did what you do. And then sold it. And then came more and more. And then... The first car I think I got when I passed my test was a Daimler Dart, fiberglass thing with a V8, 1.5 engine with fins at the back.
Yeah,
I remember the front flexibles had gone, so the exhaust sounded absolutely magnificent driving up. So those were the first formative experiences after I passed my test.
Presumably then, I mean, you know, normally when we go through people's car history, there's a sort of stepped evolution based upon, you know, their success and their earnings and whatnot. I would imagine with you, when you look at the cars that you've owned over the years, because you were trading them, I suppose that decision to change from this to that and that to that was more perhaps based upon, based upon perhaps, you know, being able to turn a few quid in terms of swapping it, as opposed to maybe where you wanted to go, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was about what was most fun and what was most outrageous. And I remember in my day, you would go to university and you would get a grant to buy books.
Yeah.
So
we know where this is going.
I don't know how much it was, maybe 500-800 quid. And the first thing I did was to buy a Ford Granada 3-litre GXL, because that's what Jack Reagan drove in the Sweeney. I would smoke Piccadilly cigarettes, wear this sheepskin coat, and drive this Granada, one-handing it round and getting a back end to slide, living this alternate existence in this fantasy world. You know, cars to me were really important because they just took you to another place.
Yeah.
They made you confident. They made you important. They made you self-assured. They gave you status. Yeah. And that's how I kind of identified. And that's all the way through my life. There have been this talisman of just, you know, not just a hobby, but a real connection with something that's hard to explain. And you know what this is about, Jason, don't you?
Yeah.
They once they get you cars... Ooh. They
and
really
they
get you. You can never, ever put them down. I'm really happy to have been able to enjoy my life with this amazing hobby that's given me so much pleasure. And I've been able to, you know, being on Top Gear allowed you to drive a McLaren F1 at 200 miles an hour and Ferrari Daytonas and stuff like this, which you'd never be able to do normally. So
absolutely.
It's just been pure adrenaline. A really great ride.
It's difficult to explain, isn't it, that occasionally a car comes along, and let's say you've had it for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, let's just say, and when you park it up and you walk away from it, there's still that inner reaction where you've got to turn around and have a look.
Yes.
I mean, it is kind of love affair, isn't it?
It's like fancying it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think it is? When it is that thing exactly when you do, you give it a little look over your shoulder as you're walking away, because you kind of go, still fancy that
you.
Car.
And if it doesn't do that to you, then it really shouldn't be at the party.
Mm,
you know, it's got to be able to turn your or tickle your heart with delicate fingers. And we've had them all, early 911s that you just couldn't walk away without turning back. And not just looking at it, but just drinking it in.
Yeah.
Mm. E-types were another one. And Ferrari Daytonas, and I had a Dino once, and you would have to walk away from that car backwards.
Moonwalking, Quentin.
Yeah, how funny is that?
To turn away was an act of sacrilege.
Yeah. Or even, do you remember the drive up the high street with the shop windows, and you'd be clocking your reflection? I mean, I can remember.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, does this look good? Does this pass the test, going past the plate glass windows of...
Yeah.
of some department store and you just slow down and look at yourself. I mean, it's terrible, but that's the way it was. And I guess for a lot of people still is.
Here's a tale, take the mick out of me tale. I was doing that and I was in a weird car to have a look at yourself, but I love this car. It was a Renault 19 Sport in blue. And I was having a look and I'd bumped into the car in front. Yeah. I was too busy going, oh, yeah, that's nice, isn't it?
Boink. Automated vanity.
So what would you say? Probably impossible for you to answer, but you know, if you could pick a favourite car over the years, or one that is still ticks, you know, flicks your little erotic box for cars, what, you know, if you had to choose one, what would it be?
There are so many, Jason, and you know this. I mean, I think the one car that I remember most vividly, really, really being a wonderful, wonderful day, because it's defined by drives, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The car and the drive takes you over, and you remember that, and it's imprinted on your memory forever, and you can never, you know, rub it away. Was when I was filming a thing for the Ford Mustang for Top Gear in LA, and we had a day off. So what do? You've got a Mustang convertible 289. You're in LA. You head for Malibu, don't you? Down the Pacific Coast Highway, and it's beautiful weather. The hood is down. There's an 8-track, and there's an Eagles Hotel California cassette in there. Push it in. Arm out the window. Box of cigarettes off. And I mean, it was just lovely. It was an hour and a half of pure, beautiful,
bliss.
Just
bliss.
Fantasy made real. And the Pacific Ocean there and the lovely temperature, just not going fast, just burbling along and listening to Hotel California and thinking, if I die right now, this is it.
I'm tickety-boo.
You know, and I'm lucky enough to have bought a 64 Mustang 260 convertible, which I still have. And that always reminds me of that magical drive, although it's never the same when you take it to the UK and try to do the same thing, because the PCH is the PCH. But that would be the kind of magical drive and the magical car that I remember most fondly.
Wow. Okay, this might be easy then.
It's modest, really.
Yeah. This might be easy then, Quentin. Worst car stroke biggest motoring mistake?
Two, I guess. I remember once I bought a Fiat 124 and it just was so crap that it kept breaking down. And then I had to get this guy to come and pick me up with a Land Rover. And he hooked me up and we were driving through Leicester. And I'm steering this thing, and he's quite enthusiastic, and he's driving. I'm thinking, come on, mate, come on, let's slow down, slow down. And then suddenly the tow rope just detaches itself from his ball hitch. I've got no engine, so I'm just, and I just hit the steps of the Odeon Cinema.
Ah.
Just like, you know, the most embarrassing moment in my life. That would be a pretty grim car. And then there was a Montego, a hearing aid beige, Austin Montego.
Oh, that's one of my
car auctions. And I knew, you know, instinct was saying, look, that's a horrible looking car. It don't even go near it. But I thought, come on, I need to go home. I'll buy something for a bit of trade. I drove it down the M1, and then the entire contents of the sump deposited. And then that's it. I'm on the hard shoulder with all the red lights on, and it's scrap. But here we are. So.
That's one of my ultimate colours, that hearing aid beige. It's a beauty, isn't it?
But it's come back.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there was a time when you wouldn't go near those British Leyland cars, which were described as champagne. And when you got them, they were the colour of hearing aids.
Yeah.
And now Audi, you know, BMW, they're all doing this funny kind of greys and flat beiges. Who knows? Whatever, you know.
90 Day White. That's another cracking colour, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So, what's the everyday current motor? What's the workhorse?
So the workhorse is a Tesla Model 3 Performance. Ooh. So that does the job, you know. 0-63.1 seconds, 163 miles an hour. What's not to love?
I mean, it is an extraordinary little thing, though, isn't it?
Unbelievable, you know. And I remember first driving it thinking, good Lord, this is unfeasibly fast.
Yeah.
And I get 300 miles out of it at one
Do
charge.
you?
Yeah. And I remember, I mean, I think Elon does something to the batteries of his test cars, but we were driving this thing down the M40, trying to use up all the juice and putting on the heated seats and the air conditioning and everything to try and use the battery up. And you just couldn't. And it was just, and I thought, I've got to have one. So I've had that for 3 years now, 36,000 miles, still on the original tyres. In 3 years, I've spent £120 in maintenance.
Is that right?
That's it. And I mean, look, and that was only because I wasn't using the brakes enough, because you've got the regen.
Yeah.
So you don't touch the brakes, so they get corroded. So I had to take it to Tesla just to free them off. But it's been completely and utterly blameless. Nothing. Nothing's gone wrong. Nothing's had to be replaced. And so when you think about this, I love all the noise and all the smoke and all the cacophony of internal combustion cars. But really, these electric things are just so good, so reliable, so quick, so silent, so superior in so many ways, apart from that emotional connection, that for day-to-day stuff, it's great, Cost me £8 to go to London and back.
I must admit, until I did the recent series of Fifth Gear, which is, Recharge, about electric cars, I'd really not, other than had a quick blast in a couple, experience and live with them for a day or so. And it's quite a game changer, isn't it? When you actually take the plunge and you live with it, they are quite something, aren't they?
I mean, look, I've come from the dark side, haven't I? I mean, who told us all to buy all these combustion cars, these big V12s. And here am I, saying, look, electric cars are good and you need to take them seriously. And the technology works. And just imagine, it's been 10 years from being able to buy them, 12 years being able to buy them as production cars in showrooms, to now, and we can do 300 plus miles. Imagine what it's going to be like in the next 10 years when you've got solid state batteries and 1,000 mile ranges and stuff like that. So it is, reluctantly the future.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm glad we got onto this, because, we had to talk to you about EVs, Quentin, arguably the most influential campaigner for electric vehicles in this country, I would suggest. Do you see a time when we're all driving EVs, or do you think that we'll see a landscape that also includes synthetic fuels in terms of maintaining existing hardware and existing infrastructure?
Look, I'm very open-minded. I don't want to be prescriptive about electric cars, or indeed hydrogen cars, or e-fuels. Look, all these technologies are parallel, and anything that can get rid of the particulates in the air, that can reduce our dependency on fossil fuels, that means that we don't have to be slaves to Putin and Saudi Arabia, has to be a good thing. So I think you're going to have a mixed source of energy. You're going to have electric. We'll have hydrogen for larger vehicles and things, not for passenger cars. Mm-hmm. And if we can make e-fuels so they genuinely have a benefit and reduce CO2 and carbon and nitrous oxide, then great, that's fine. Mm. And there will be people who will never drive electric cars or hydrogen or e-fuels, and that's fine, and they can do that. Mm. They can drive their diesel until they drop. And I think, we've all of us got to say electric cars aren't for everybody. Mm. But from my point of view, they work. And I think there's a huge amount of investment, of jobs, of benefits to society if we can do it right, and we can get the research and development in to make the batteries and make this country, one of the leaders in that technology. I think China's got the drop on us, but it would be silly if we gave up now. But I mean, you go to London, you walk along the Marylebone Road, you can taste the pollution in the air, and I think that's something we've got to sort out. Yeah. Classic cars are fine; they've repaid their carbon debt many, many times over. So when I'm driving around in my 60-year-old Ford Mustang, I'm not worried, because, it's the greenest car of all, because it hasn't been scrapped and replaced with another one.
Yeah.
So I think, if we're civilized and intelligent, we've got to look at this and say that the days of total combustion car domination are over. And we now can get these technologies that do work well and that are fast and that are silent. And, you know, the liberty of not having to pay 700 quid every time you take your car in to be serviced. And not having to go to the petrol station and fill up your Range Rover and 120 quid. It just is unbelievable. It really, really is. And I had Range Rovers for 10 years and you just... And then you look at it now and you think, wow, what was it doing? But I think it's really wrong to be prescriptive and dictatorial and say, look, this is what you have to do. And the government switched its target from 2030 to 2035, which I can understand why they did it, but it has confused car makers and it has confused consumers. So you've got these 10 model cycles of 7 years. So people like JLR and Stellantis and Ford have already decided that they're making EVs now for the next seven years indefinitely. And just suddenly to pull the rug from underneath them wasn't very bright. And this is a government, you know, looking for sort of culture wars and populism as it sees its majorities declining. So that didn't help, I think. And you know, anybody listening who thinks, do I buy an electric car? Do I think about an electric car? I would say yes, because they do work. But the most important thing is to talk to people who own and drive and charge electric cars. Someone who has had one for, you know, a couple of years, like me, 3 years, because it's no good people who have never bought or driven or charged an electric car telling you the reasons why you should never buy or drive an electric car.
You know what? That's so true, isn't it?
You know?
That's so true.
And don't forget, there are lots of vested interests ranged against this. You know, this it's hugely disruptive. And we're talking trillions and trillions of pounds of money of being displaced eventually by this transition. So obviously there are people who don't want it, and there's forces being ranged against it. So you've got to weigh up all the stuff you read in the newspapers and say, well, is that really, you know, are car parks going to collapse because of the weight of EVs? Are EVs responsible for all the potholes on the roads? What was the other one? Are we going to lose our front gardens because of EV charging? And you kind of look at these things and they stack up to shoulder height and you think, who's behind this?
Well, yeah. So here's a great question. And all of our guests, they think long and hard about this. Of all the cars you've ever owned, if you had to pick one and live with it for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
It's a really, really hard one, as you say, and it's difficult because you live with it. Let me just spin the question slightly, and if I had, you know, unlimited funds and wanted to buy the car that would make me utterly and completely complete and happy, it would have to be an AC Cobra.
Oh wow!
Little 29 AC Cobra coil spark. Yeah. 64, 65,
nice.
UK car. And just, you know, that was just, it was so lovely. It was so quick, so light in its feet, so beautiful, so completely right for its time. And I drove one, well, drove several. And they're just wonderful. They're just, you know, not that fast really compared to my Tesla, but the noise and the visceral stuff. That would be £1 million, mind you, now.
Yeah, I know.
And I can remember time, and I bet you can, Jason, when they weren't, you know, they 20,000, 25,000, you could buy one, boom.
I know. You know.
But then if you bought one, you would have never sold it, would you? You would keep it until you died.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's so true, you wouldn't. You'd hang on to it, because they're gorgeous, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So that, but then there's lots of other ones, Bentley Continental Flying Spur, any type. It would have to be an early 3.8, then another Dino, then a Dino, and the list just gets out of control, you know. And you'd have this huge car park for all these cars that you then have to tax and insure and fuel and keep the batteries charged, and you know.
Well, listen, Quentin, there is one final question that we ask all of our guests, and it's almost as if you've looked forward on the script because you've kind of gone there already, albeit accidentally, when you were talking about the Pacific Coast Highway and you were talking about journeys and cars. However, imagine you didn't say that, and imagine I was giving you this for the first time. Okay, what we always say is music and cars go well together, we think, so we want your fantasy drive, or rather another fantasy drive. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
Okay, so it would, again, I'm afraid it would have to be in America.
That's right.
And I don't know whether it'd be the PCH or just, you know, let's go a little bit further past past Malibu and go up to Carmel. It's still a nice drive up there. And I'd probably do it in a Porsche 356.
Okay.
Convertible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With ZZ Top sharp dressed man. Same deal, just, you know, escapism, pure and simple.
See, you know what? I can picture that in my head now.
So can I.
I can picture how lush that would be.
Mm.
It would be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would indeed.
I can even imagine the closing shot off a drone as well, just sort of coming backwards as we see you kind of disappear into the distance. And on that note, Jason, beautifully, I think you need to take us out.
Well, sadly, we do have to leave it today. So that's it for this week's Fueling Round with Adrian Flux, the UK's largest specialist insurance broker. Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs, help you save your money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you to you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Quentin Wilson.
Quentin, it was wonderful. Thank you very much indeed. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da.